So Michael Cullen has had a long and distinguished career in academia, politics and business governance. The former Labour Finance Minister, Deputy Prime Minister and close confidant of Helen Clark is best known for introducing the New Zealand Superannuation Fund, also known as the Cullen Fund, KiwiSaver and the Working for Families package. I would add to that perhaps negotiating the fallout from the Foreshore and Seabed Uprising that ultimately became the Foreshore and Seabed Act. So Michael was an Otago University history lecturer when he was first elected to Parliament in 1981 in the Dunedin seat of St Kilda for the last term of the Muldoon National Government. When the David Longy, Roger Douglas 4th Labour government came to power in 1984, he became senior whip, giving him a ringside seat to the era of Rogernomics and the implosion of the relationship between the Prime Minister and Finance Minister. After leaving politics in 2009, Sir Michael became chairman of New Zealand Post, chair of the Tax Working Group and Earthquake Commission, and on the boards of the Bay of Plenty District Health Board and Lakes District Health Board. He was also part of a review of the security services. Earlier last year, he was diagnosed with cancer, for which he has been receiving palliative chemotherapy. So Michael has just released his memoir called Labour Saving. It is published by Allen and Unwin, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Sir Michael to 9 to Noon from his home in Ohope. Kia ora and welcome, Sir Michael.
Good morning, Catherine.
Listeners will first want to know, how are you? How are things going for you day to day?
Not too bad. I've had a sort of bad period just the last 2-3 months with, first of all, a bacterial infection in the blood, and then a period where I thought something had gone completely wrong with my life, but it turned out to be a lot of fluid on my lungs. They took off about 3.5 litres, and now I'm on medication for congestive heart failure causing that kind of liquid. So I've dropped another about 10 kilos or so in the last few weeks, which I didn't really have to spare, but never mind. I'm still a visible side on, just.
It's interesting, right at the end of the book, that you address your state of mind and your philosophical approach to where life's at. And it comes across as remarkably reconciled and grateful, actually. Would that sum it up, along with, I'm sure, the times you wonder what the hell's next?
That's right. This last little bout of illness over the last 3 months has knocked a lot out of me. But I've been very lucky in terms of the cancer. The 4 rounds of chemotherapy I had last year has knocked it right back. I cross my fingers every time because, of course, there's always the next scan, and the next scan may show that the cancer's coming back, which it is expected to do. But I'm already really past what would have been a reasonable expectation of life when the diagnosis was done early last year.
What's been the process?
That's right.
What's been the process for writing the memoir, which, of course, as well as your early life, covers nearly 40 years of recent political history? What was your process?
Yes. Well, as I said in the preface, it started off, my intention was to write just a few pages on my personal life, and not really about the political stuff at all. And I started that soon after the chemotherapy as something to do. This will keep me going for a few days. But it kind of grew, and I found it impossible actually to write something about my personal life only, because I belong to a different sort of generation, I think, which is sort of less tends towards long and florid descriptions about how brilliant one is. And then stamp CV on the front of it. So I started getting right into the politics and the business of, you know, getting elected and then having been elected, what I did and what Parliament was doing and so on at the time. And so in the end, I ended up with a large book, which was even larger than the one that's printed. I took out about 25,000 words, I think, including most of the best jokes, because the defamation lawyer was a bit worried about some of my jokes. I don't think he was actually a New Zealander, because he didn't seem to know much about New Zealand politics.
Some of the jokes remain. We'll talk about them. Indulge the political junkies among us, because there are some insights here in particular. I wanted to just touch on that fourth Labor government era, because I really found some stuff there that I hadn't quite perceived before in other people's writings. And particularly the mission creep of its reform agenda. Can you explain more about this, and especially, as you write it, by the Finance Minister, Roger Douglas, how much of that economic reform programme was in the plans, so to speak, in the run-up to the 84 election or in the early term, and how much more was proposed in stages as time went on?
Well, I think there was certainly a reform programme in Roger's mind and those gathered around him before the 84 election. And that's why there was one hell of an argument at the New Zealand Policy Council with Jeffrey in the end writing a sort of pretty anodyne document which tried to cover the various sides. In fact, and that was reflected in the speech from the throne at the start of that parliament in 84. But the reality was that there were major things to be done, just getting out of the wage price freeze and out of the sort of complete rejection of the price mechanism as the basis of any kind of market economy took quite a long time. And it took most of the first term in one way or another. And I think if one looks at Roger's progression from still writing things like pamphlets called Picking Winners in the early 1980s and proposing 16 carpet factories be set up by the government for the 81 election policy, there was quite a big jump to 84, but there was a bigger jump still which kept on going. And what I try and explain in the book is two things. Firstly, that for most of that period, I think Roger still believed everything he was doing was in the best interest of the people who elected the Labour government, as well as New Zealand as a whole. I don't think he was part of a sort of a QAnon plot to sort of completely undermine the traditional basis of New Zealand society and economy. But he also had an endlessly restless personality and mind, and therefore was always moving on to the next thing. So while some people, like obviously Milton Friedman and co, have written, if you like, the plan out in a complete form, I think Roger kind of progressed from one bit to another because he couldn't actually stop anywhere. And that was the problem. I mean, he was able to carry David with him up until April 1987, but then produced a plan for the budget in 87, which was due only a few weeks later, which started heering off in a quite different direction, quite contrary to traditional Labour Party philosophy and values. While I was in the more sort of modernising camp, which was how do we keep those values and modernise our economy.
In fact, you've described him, and this is, he was eventually sacked, Douglas, of course, by Longy before Longy himself resigned as PM, but you've described him as, quote, bitterly resenting not being able to finish the job, but in fact psychologically unable to do so. And was this, your opinion, of course, but was this the experience of the caucus, which seems to be kind of a bit riven anyway over how the whole program was accelerating? But was this your observation, that every time you thought it was done, something else would appear?
Yes, and of course by the latter part of 1987, I was in the cabinet anyway, it could see these things at first hand. I was a senior whip, but I knew nothing about the April argument between David and Roger over the budget. That was kept very close within senior ministers. I think if it had got out to the caucus at that point, there would have been some pretty serious ructions. I think a lot of the caucus sort of got carried along. Loyalty and the belief that we were doing major reforms carried the caucus through. And because, in essence, each step was taken just beyond the previous step, so that was a progression, not here is the map for remaking the world. I think a lot of the caucus was able to sort of put aside their own qualms about much of this, and it was impacting many people in their electorates, and stay sort of loyal. But when things started bursting open after the 87 election, and with the share market crash in the US, then it became obvious that we were really heading off in a quite new direction, and more and more the caucus, and indeed increasingly the cabinet, began to have reservations about where this was going.
You write about it being a Shakespearean, I'm not sure whether you wanted to call it a tragedy or a comedy, in the end, a tragicomedy perhaps, of the way it imploded. But the intensity and the desperation of the emotions and people in different places, those fiercely fighting against it, those fiercely fighting for it, those in the middle sort of being dragged along, as you say. You describe, I think, one caucus meeting where you break down, so upset at what was the self-destruction that was happening. Another where you appear to be, the pair of you, you and Preble, appear to be coming close to coming to blows. Like, this is full on. Have you seen anything like it since?
Well, of course, there was the second round of internal turmoil with Helen's challenge to Mike Moore in after the 1983 election. That caused a lot of ill feeling and bitterness. But in a sense, it was sort of over, except for the fact that things didn't go well over the next couple of years or so. Even though we were sort of building, if you like, a more traditional policy approach. And so that led to the delegation to Helen, which she saw off. But from then on, I mean, the next 12 and a half years were so different from the first 12 and a half years that I had in Parliament, because that runs through to sort of early 1994. But there's no comparison. I mean, we had a very stable leadership team in Helen and myself from mid-96. We have very few big arguments, not that many little arguments. And one of the problems I found in writing the book is you remember the bad times and the arguments more than you remember the good times and the smoothness. It's one of, I think, the features of being a politician. You remember those sort of dreaded times when you're going to caucus thinking, okay, what the hell are we going to argue about today? How are we going to come out and look all bright and smiley, ready for the House to start at 2 o'clock this afternoon?
It's interesting, those early years of opposition after Labor was decimated somewhat in 1990, you describe them, the early days, literally, as your best performances in the House. Many politicians loathe opposition and sink without sight in opposition. You appeared to thrive on it at this time.
Well, I was very lucky that two things happened. Helen was overseas for part of that period, and she was the deputy leader, of course, and Labour spokesperson. And, of course, they were bringing in the Employment Contracts Act, and I was the stand-in for that. And then they were also bringing in benefit cuts and changes before Christmas, and I was still the social welfare spokesperson, having carried on in that role after being the minister. So I had a lot of opportunities, not just for debating, but for leading the debate for the opposition and trying to get some sense of unity and some sense of this is not a hopeless quest. We're in here to fight and fight all the way to the next election. And, of course, we nearly pulled it off in 1993. I mean, we didn't increase our vote, but we did see the net vote collapsing, and they just squeaked back in.
You do suggest Helen Clark challenged Moore for the leadership too early. What were the consequences of that? I've been a little more direct than you were, but that's essentially what you're saying. What were the consequences of that?
I think the consequences are, first of all, of course, some continued hard feelings within the caucus. But Helen was quite careful to choose people from both sides in her you know, shadow cabinet, if you want to call it that. But also, Mike had strong support in the public. While some of the commentators could not understand that, he came across, if you like, as a sort of genuine Kiwi who'd made good, had a really tough time of it in his early life, and had made good to become, well, Prime Minister for a few weeks and then leader of the opposition. And so there was strong residual loyalty at a personal level to Mike in the public arena and in parts of the party, which continued, unfortunately, the split in the party. And at no point really did we get sort of going in opposition and building up to the point where we could have a reasonable chance of winning the next election. And, of course, complicating that fact was the fact that the next election was going to be an MMP one, and we had two new political groupings in New Zealand First and the Alliance, both of whom were feeding off us, as well as particularly New Zealand First occasionally feeding off the National Party. So we found it very hard, and we were hitting polling results of under 20% in some of the polls, and Helen was hitting awful numbers around 2 or 3 and just not getting cut through with the public. She was seen as, you know, sort of, to use Michael Bassett's actual nickname for Helen, she was seen as a kind of Lady Macbeth who'd put the king to death, if you like. And her reputation slowly built in the later 1990s as the then National Coalition with New Zealand First struggled, and Helen's sort of consistency and her hard work and her clarity of thought and expression started to come through more. And while you could argue that she got more light while in government, in opposition she got a lot of increase in terms of respect and trust in that second term that she was the leader in opposition. And that's why we were able to win in 1999.
It's a relationship you don't elaborate on. You describe it very succinctly as one of, you know, cooperation and respect and working together very closely. But what we don't get a sense of so much is how it evolved from you being on Moore's side in the initial vote and being part of the party that made what appears to be a rather brief visit to her office to ask her to stand down. And to this very close and productive relationship in government. But we don't hear how that evolved or how your personalities work together very smoothly by observation and government. But how would you describe that relationship's journey?
Well, we're very different personalities in many ways, rather obviously. I mean, Helen is a more serious person than I am, and she was dedicated to the political life and had, I think, always wanted to become the leader of the Labour Party. I found myself at one point in the position of avoiding becoming leader of the Labour Party in October 1995, and was very pleased about that. We are obviously met frequently. I mean, she'd just call me up and I'd pop upstairs, or she'd sometimes come downstairs. We talk things over. We usually have Heather Simpson with us, so that the government especially worked very much as a kind of triumvirate between Helen and myself and Heather. And then there was a sort of next circle out of people like Pete Hodgson and so on, who were the sort of next ring of the inner ring of ministers. There was a sort of inner cabinet, in effect, of about 8 or 9 people. So very little was done without each of us having a clear knowledge of what the other was wanting to do and what the steps in that were. So she built up a lot of trust in me, and that enabled me to work on a lot of things, get to the point where they were doable and then go and talk with her and Heather and say, well, let's think about this and what we can do.
It sounds functional, Sir Michael. Yeah, it sounds functional, but you were both rather busy people.
We were very busy people. I mean, I was always had at least three portfolios because I was always leader of the house, and then I was Minister of Revenue for one term and holding the other portfolios, accident compensation to start off with for a year to do the renationalisation, as people called it, of ACC. I mean, Helen, like all prime ministers, spent a lot of her time doing public functions. I mean, I think it's been a sort of inevitable tendency from maybe the days of Walter Nash and Keith Holyoake of not spending an awful lot of time out in the public arena doing public things, opening this, being at that, and so on and so forth. That's got more and more the focus of the Prime Minister's attention. So that makes having a number two who the Prime Minister trusts and can take over in the House and so on when she's away that much more important. So she needed to have that trust in me. Occasionally I'd make a bit of a joke about it when I went through the House, because they asked me when Helen was away, so I was the acting PM in the House for question time. They asked me, did the Prime Minister have trust in the Minister of Finance? and I got up and said, yes, because he is what was the phrase he always used, a hardworking and something minister. But his performance in the next couple of minutes may cause me to change my mind, which had all our caucus laughing and half the opposition laughing as well, which ruined entirely the question for the poor opposition member asking.
Which you did often. I do recall you referring to the government having gone skiing once as well.
Yes, I was a bit out of favour on that for a little while. She was making a promotional documentary for Discovery Channel for New Zealand. I had no idea. I thought she'd actually gone on a few days' holiday break, which I was quite pleased about, not because I didn't wander around, but because I thought she did need to take a break from time to time. I think most prime ministers work too hard.
So Michael Cullenzaugi's Labour Saving is the book. Let's talk a little bit about the philosophy that you touch on in various parts of the book, and that I think leads to a straight line to some of those major initiatives you were most associated with, working for families, an interesting sort of juxtaposition for redistribution between broad tax cuts and welfare. It kind of sits in the middle. It was deliberately targeted at families. KiwiSaver and the Superfund, which are the two big legacies. I also want to talk about the Foreshore and Seabed Act before I let you off the call. But I'm interested in the political philosophy. You hinted it. You talk about essentially being an egalitarian. I think you'd confess to pretty much being a Keynesian by bent when it comes to economic management. And that makes some sense when you look at what that fifth Labor government did. But could you speak to a little bit more about the why of that? You also say we don't pay enough tax to have the kind of society that we want. The why of that? What got you to the position you are in on the political spectrum and not somewhere else?
Well, I don't want to be unkind to my old secondary school, but winning a scholarship to Christ College gave me a very clear insight into the sort of upper reaches of particularly Canterbury society. And I was quite sort of surprised by how we were always being told that we were the leaders of the future. And I looked around at half my sort of peers in the third or fourth form or whatever, and thought, my God, they're our leaders of the future. This is pretty bad news for New Zealand. But many of them actually did become leaders, although I was the sort of star political leader of my whole generation out of Christ College. And that reinforced the background that I came from, where my grandparents grew up in poverty. My parents were sort of modestly affluent, mainly because my mother went out to paid employment. And we kind of moved up the social scale. Mum was the first one to go to grammar school. I was the first one to go to tertiary education. These were the sort of bricks on which my life was built, and they were built around opportunity, but also a recognition, which I think if you have talents in any particular area, it's a very important thing to try to keep your head in the right place. Just because you're good at thinking and writing or rugby or cricket or whatever doesn't necessarily make you a better person or make you a more worthy person than somebody who has no particularly great talents. Those talents are not something you created. You've used them, you've developed them, but they were there from a very early stage. And you got lucky in the draw, or I got lucky in the draw, obviously, as I'm saying, in that respect. I do have a very intelligent mind, though not as intelligent as it was a year or so back, I think I can fairly say, too much medication. And I do have a very quick mind, which can get me into trouble and did, but often got me out of trouble, more often got me out of trouble, and often was very helpful in terms of question time and parliamentary debate. So that sort of belief is both embedded in some generations of my past, but also... I think is part of recognizing that the people all around you are all pretty well all trying to make worthwhile contributions to their family, their society, and so on. And you should not get sort of carried away with your own value.
I find that interesting because you're not shy about your own intelligence or quickness of mind, which is refreshing. And those of us who've witnessed that acerbic humour can attest to its brilliance, actually. One of the House's great performers. There's just no two ways about it. But at times it felt like it tipped into something else, something almost a bit angry. And I wonder if what you've just explained is what might set that off sometimes.
Oh, yes. I mean, there were a few occasions on which, well, quite a few occasions I got angry. I mean, I would get angry about legislation which ran directly contrary to those views. I mean, those benefit cuts at the end of 1990, the Employment Contracts Act, which not just destroyed much of the trade union movement, but destroyed particularly much of the trade union movement, which was representing those workers who otherwise had very little chance of strong representation. I mean, people like the Clerical Workers Union just disappeared in the space of months. And then also, when people opposite in the National Party started behaving and talking as they're wont to do, as if they are somehow the natural rulers of our country. And I really used to sometimes look across the House and think, goodness me, really? I mean, this today even, you look across at the National Party benches and you think, what a dull lot of people they are. I mean, the contrast between the Labour caucus, sort of many-hued, many-talented, many this and many other things, and then you look across at the sort of serried ranks of blue suits and the men and whatever in the women, and you think, they're not a very interesting lot, are they? don't represent much of New Zealand's modern diversity. Let's put it that way.
I'm leading you down a path. Now, we must, I'll see if you can recall it. Everyone misquotes what you said during the ERA debate. They misquoted as, "We won, you lost, eat that." I recall it as, "We won, you lost, it goes, eat that." What do you recall it as?
Well, I could never find it in Hansard.
Neither could I. I went looking.
I went looking, and I can swear that I did not delete anything from Hansard. The only time I had trouble with Hansard was when I described Derek Quigley as dragging his headlong into the 19th century. And the poor old Hansard writers thought I'd made a mistake and changed it to 20th century. This was in the 20th century. And I had to change it back to 19th century, otherwise the point of the statement was completely lost. And I thought it was quite witty, but they clearly didn't even begin to understand what I was saying. I can't remember.
We'll just have to go with my official record then, Sir Michael.
The official record is that I went silent for a few seconds, apparently. And, of course, the point I was making was we were fighting in that first year the sort of combined assumption of much of the business sector and the National Party that we had no right to be the government. I mean, we'd gone to the people with very clear policies in a whole range of areas, and it was somehow illegitimate that we were going to implement them. And I just found this sort of really strange. It was an insight into the minds of a lot of people. They think that we would have gone to all that trouble spelling out what we're going to do in labour relations, but we didn't actually mean to do it. We would just sort of accept that, no, business wanted the Employment Contracts Act, so we would carry on with that. And Helen and I were determined to prove that you could have a government that did what it said it was going to do.
Let's touch on the, and it's too brief for time to go near it, you cover it in some detail in the book, I would almost call it the trauma, really, of the Foreshore and Seabed Act, given rise to by the Chief Justice's ruling that there may be pockets of customary title left and that should be able to be explored in the Māori Land Court. The government, I recall you saying, words to the effect of it could amount to a bundle of rights that could, in effect, be exclusive ownership. That's not acceptable and we're legislating. Now, it caused tremendous trauma and pain. It caused a hikoi. It birthed a new political party and you were left negotiating the way through. The one question I want to ask you is that with the absolute benefit of 2020 hindsight, was that legislation necessary? Was it knee-jerk? Could things have happened another way?
Well, I think one major problem, there are many major problems. The first major problem was that the Te Tū Whenua Māori Act, which was passed in 1993, provided essentially that once you had a customary title, once it was determined to be customary land, then effectively it was a bit like an Oxford MA. You could just go along to the court and you get issued full freehold title, or more freehold titles. It's the same thing in practice. Now, that, of course, was an entirely different kettle of fish. Freehold title to foreshore and seabed would mean that other people could be excluded, people could be charged to go on to the foreshore itself, which isn't, of course, the main part of the beach. But people didn't understand that. Pākehā didn't understand that anyway. Māori quickly got the notion, many of Māori got the notion, that what the Court of Appeal had actually said was that they owned the foreshore and seabed. Sean Elias's statement was very, very much more confined than that. And it was clear there was going to be quite a long process of trying to determine who might have customary title and so on. There was all the issues around freedom of navigation and all these other things, issues of international law, which we would have to cover off in some way or another. And very quickly, people weren't listening to each other. I mean, we did put out in December a set of proposals, which I'm quite convinced could have become what was eventually passed as the Takatauana Act by the National Government in 2011. It did provide for customary title or an inalienable title, which was a customary title, which was a property right. Which you had to apply to the High Court, and you could go to the Māori Land Court to establish customary rights of usage. The problem was that nobody was listening by that stage. We lost Tariana and for a little while Nanaia, and that changed the numbers. We were in a perilous situation that we were reliant for our first agreement on the whole of our caucus, plus Alliance, plus United Future, in order to pass legislation. Once one of ours left, the only option we had was New Zealand First. And they were, well, Winston was adamantly opposed to customary title, for reasons I could never understand, and also insisted on having a whole section, which was really quite silly, whereby Pākehā groups were supposed to be able to apply for customary title, since they had to have had usage rights since 6th of February 1840. That was entirely unlikely that anybody would be able to do so. That's why when, after the 2008 election, I persuaded my colleagues in the caucus that we should actually back a change of legislation. And fundamentally, the Takatauana Act is what we would have ended up with.
It's what you wanted in the first place. Can I ask you, I'm just conscious of your time, of your political opponents, who did you most respect?
Oh, gosh.
It's going to be hard for you.
That's going to be hard, yes. Not because I don't respect, I respect a lot of them, even ones who make strange mistakes, like Bill English. But I respect his intelligence and his integrity in the House. I came increasingly to respect Jim Bulger's ability to keep a coalition together. I mean, it's significant that the coalition fell apart after he was dethroned, and particularly by putting Jenny Shipley in place, that's what almost ensured that the coalition would fall apart, because the Shipley-Peters chemistry was clearly not there of a sort that was required to make things work. Helen put enormous efforts into keeping Winston reasonably happy, if he's ever reasonably happy, I don't know. There were people I admired in the debating, like Paul from Rotorua. Forgot my surname. He was an excellent debater. There were people like George Gere in the early days I was in Parliament.
Paul East, we're thinking of. Paul East?
Paul East. George Gere. I immensely admire Jim Rattray for his integrity at the change of government in 1984. That took some courage.
Silence on John Key, who ultimately ended the fifth Labour government.
John Key, I admired his tremendous skills in being personable. I mean, I think he's naturally personable, but he also sort of built on that personability. I admired his ability to keep a completely straight and honest face while, shall we say, being somewhat manipulative with the data.
Michael,
that's why I find it so hard to debate in the 2005 election, when he was the finance spokesperson, because he'd say things that are completely untrue with a completely open and honest face. I'm sitting there saying, what the hell do I say now?
Well, there's a three-term prime ministership for you. Michael, thank you very much for your generous time, and thank you for the book.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for all your work on radio.
So Michael Cullen, Labour Saving is the memoir.